It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Japanese forces attacked Americans at Pearl Harbor on this day in 1941, leading the U.S. to enter World War II. We learned about America's ambassador to Tokyo at the time and his experience in the lead-up to the war. First, the holiday season is a time of celebration, gift-giving, and often giving back to our communities. Sometimes, though, taking that first step toward volunteering or donating can be a little challenging if you don't know where to start. Our next guest is an internationally recognized philanthropic advisor with advice on how to make the most of the giving season. You could join in at 800-642-1234. How do you like to give back to your own community during the holidays? Do you volunteer? What do you do? What got you started? How do you decide where to make donations this time of year? Do you have questions needing some advice from our guest, maybe? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Lisa Dietlin is a keynote speaker, author, and founder of the Institute for of Transformational Philanthropy. Lisa, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, we think of this as a season of giving. What are some of the themes or messages you think about a lot during this time of year?
You know, some of the things I think about are how Americans are so focused at this time of year on giving back, and yet philanthropy and need is there 365 days a year. I am so pleased that we have a time of year when we all come together and congregate and say, I want to make a difference. I want to give some money. I want to make sure people have food on their table, or if they're children, maybe a gift under the tree. But I also want to continue that education so that people realize it's not just one and done. It's all year long.
How can people make that mindset shift, maybe instead of that once a year donation, which is also great, or once a year volunteer gig, to say, hey, maybe I'm going to start a habit of doing stuff like this?
Well, you're speaking my language, Rob. You're definitely, you know that. You know that. You teed that up perfectly. You know, first of all, to level set, 80% of nonprofits receive 50% of their budget in the last 2 months of the year. Now, imagine, you know, our listeners, if you got, you know, 80% of your salary, or 50% of your salary in the last 2 months of the year, you'd be like, wait a minute, I worked all these other months and how do I make it stretch? So actually thinking about how do we make a charitable plan of action? And I think it should be a family affair. I think it's something that we need to teach both those who are older. I've taught my mother and my brother and my sister how to give, and as well as my nieces and nephews. So one of the first things I would say is have a conversation during the holidays, whether it's one-on-one or at the family table, or as you're sitting around getting ready to watch that football game, or, you know, that holiday special. We always watch the Christmas Story, you know, sitting there and talk about, what did you do this year? What did you do to give back? And what's your plan of action? Because sometimes just starting the conversation will motivate the family to begin thinking about, oh yeah, we have been really blessed, or, oh yeah, we went through a tough time and people helped us. Maybe we should help them.
Now, we think of giving as a way to help other people. One little secret, and I've heard this from a lot of people in the psychological field. You talk about this in your latest newsletter, Lisa. Giving is a great way to help ourselves, especially maybe for feeling a little seasonal sadness with the sunlight going down and things like that. What are some of the things we get out of doing nice things for others, whether that's donating to a cause or just helping out somebody we know?
Well, you know, it's a great question. And actually, we live in a time when medical and scientific studies have been done, Rob, and there's actually data to show that individuals who volunteer, give back, do something for somebody else actually are happier. They have an instant return on investment. You know, they're happier and they actually are healthier. There's been studies done to show that people who regularly volunteer are actually healthier than those who don't volunteer. Your blood pressure goes down. You get out of the blues, you know, whether they're wintertime blues. I'm a summer blues. You know, I'm a summer baby. And when that sun is bright and shining, everyone's out, I'm like, oh my gosh, you know, and I thought I was crazy. But, you know, you can get out of the blues by helping someone else or doing something. And, you know, it does not have to be formalized or structured. You know, I want to give two examples here. One is a very structured. My family, we, you know, grew. I mean, there's six nieces and nephews and they're married and there's babies and all of this going on. And it just got to be too much. And so what we all do is put in what we would normally spend on a gift, for another person, and we do layaway angels. When the economy is tough, as for some people it is right now, we go into a store and we pay off someone's layaway, and so that they can have those items out before the holidays. That's a very structured family commitment that we all look forward to, and we call ourselves, you know, layaway angels. The other thing is that you can just be kind to somebody. You know, you can hold the door open, you can smile, you can shovel their walk, you could rake their leaves if there's still leaves, you know, blowing around, sweep out the garage, what have you. You know, I was just coming back from England, and I was on this plane, and I was in row 42, Rob. So, you know, I'm in the back of the plane. I am in the back, and people are getting on. And first of all, here's a little pet peeve of mine. If you can't put the luggage in the overhead bin, the suitcase is too big, you know, like, fair. So I'm trying to help people and saying to people, take your time, you know, it's okay. You know, just take a deep breath. And when I sat down, the woman behind me said, "Are you a counselor?" Look up at her, and I go, "No." And she goes, "You were just so kind to everybody." And I thought, wow, how is just telling people, don't feel rushed, don't feel pressured, you know, until all of us get on the plane, you know, the plane's not going to take off. How is that something that she noticed? And I thought, it's because she hadn't seen it recently, or we've been so isolated during COVID. And sometimes just making a kind word to someone. And this is, you know this too, Rob, about me. I'm a firm believer in karma. Next plane I was on to South Carolina, you know, this gentleman says, "Can I put your luggage up for you?" And I looked at him, and I wanted to say no, like, I'm an independent woman. And I said, "You know what? No one's asked that in a long time. That would be really nice." And he put my luggage up, and I thought, just being kind, I felt good, he felt good. You know, it was a good plane ride.
Nice. Lisa Dietlin is with us from the Institute of Transformational Philanthropy. We're talking about giving and volunteering, the seasonal giving season and beyond. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you volunteer? Love to hear about it. What got you started? What keeps you going? How do you make big decisions on donating maybe this time of year or around the year? Flip it around. Do you work at an organization that depends on donations or volunteers? What do you see this time of year? What do you need? What would help you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. All right, Lisa, let's talk about making decisions on who to give, first of all, money to. Now, people might look out and see these headlines about 7-digit, 10-digit donations that really wealthy people make and thinking, you know, I can't make a difference with my giving. I know you don't buy that mindset. How can we take our limited resources and give in a way that's effective and you know, that supports our values?
Right. Well, the first thing I always say is every dollar counts. So please don't think that your $5, your $10 doesn't count. If you have a faith basis, you know, there's a story in the Bible that talks about the coin of least value and, you know, a person giving of their need, not of their excess. So, you know, every dollar, every penny counts because it helps somebody else. The second thing is determine what's important to you. I often recommend look back over the last year. You know, at this time of year, Rob, we often are reflecting. You know, we're looking forward, but we're looking back, like, what happened in the last year? Did your mom get breast cancer? Did your sister adopt a dog? Did your aunt, you know, go into a senior living facility? What happened in your family that suddenly became very important to you? Did somebody get diagnosed with a rare disease? Did you become aware of something that you weren't aware of before? And see where that stacks up with your priorities. I often say give a larger amount to fewer organizations. So say you had $100, I might give two $50 donations instead of $10 to 10 organizations. But that's my personal preference. Some people might say, well, you know, I have 10 organizations I want to give to. So first of all, determine what's important to you. Review what you did last year, because sometimes we forget. What did I give to last year? Oh yeah, that's important. My kid's school, my house of worship, my alma mater, and then set a budget. You can't save the world, but you can help a little bit. You can help somebody and you can make a difference. And then put a plan of action together for the next year. Are you going to give money away every month? Are you going to give your time away? You know, the most precious commodity all of us have is our time. It's the one thing we can't replace. How about volunteering a couple hours a month? And taking your mom with you. If your mom's like mine saying, you never spend time with me, or getting your kids in the act, you know, hey, I want you to see how fortunate you are. Let's go and walk the dogs at the dog shelter. No, we're not getting a dog, but we can walk the dogs, you know. Make it a family affair.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Dennis is with us in Green Bay. Hi, Dennis.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What are you up to, Dennis?
I am right now driving across Green Bay going to the Red Cross Center to pick up a van and volunteer to drive to Marinette, Wisconsin and pick up blood from a blood drive and bring it back to Green Bay so that it gets sent to Madison for processing through the Red Cross.
Fantastic, Dennis. That is a great work, very much appreciated, and that is a great way to volunteer, Lisa.
Absolutely. I was going to say, Dennis, is it your first time doing this, or are you a regular?
I'm a regular. I'm a regular platelet donor. I donate platelets about 22 times a year for people in cancer treatment, and then I also drive for the Red Cross, and I work as a donor ambassador, which I'm doing tomorrow in Marinette also to help them out because they don't have any volunteers up there to work at a blood drive at a corporation in Marinette and greet the donors coming in, get them all checked in, and give them snacks when they're done.
That's great. You know what, Dennis? When the COVID started, I decided that I was going to become a blood donor, and I just got my 1 gallon pin. So I'm right there with you, my friend.
Thank you so much for sharing that great story, Dennis. We are talking to Lisa Dietlin with the Institute of Transformational Philanthropy with us today to talk about the importance of giving back during the holidays and beyond and how you can get started donating money, donating your time and talent. And you can join in at 800-642-1234 with your own experiences, how you make decisions about how to give, your questions for our guest, 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with philanthropic advisor Lisa Dietlin about giving back during the holiday season and beyond. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have a story about volunteering, your own or someone you know that you want to give a shout out to, how do you make decisions of who to donate limited resources to this time of year or in your year-round giving? Do you have an experience on the other side of things, needing volunteers for the cause, the organization you work for? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Back to your calls now. Tom is with us in Milwaukee. Tom, hi.
Hi. I'd like to ask your guest, how does she balance or consider the difference between providing labor or money to a charity and trying to get legislation passed so that government can provide more help to those in need?
What are your thoughts, Lisa?
Oh, that's a great question, Tom. Thanks for asking that. You know, the nonprofit sector evolved out of a rich tradition in this country where we didn't have a monarch or a state religion to go to. And so there is that whole side of it that just goes it alone. There's also those nonprofits that fill in the gap that the government isn't able to fill when we do soup kitchens, for instance, and feeding hungry people. I think there's a multi-prong approach, and I think everyone has to do what they feel is important. You know, many nonprofits advocate, some are even lobby legislators for changes in the law and for more dollars to be directed toward the nonprofit sector. I don't think we'll ever get away from fundraising and donating our time. I think that's just in our DNA, Tom. That's how we were founded, you know, with our the great philanthropic story in the United States of America. But if you're one of those who are going to your legislature and advocating or writing your senators and your congresspeople, I'd say keep at it, because the need always surpasses the resources that are available. And that's the toughest part. If you've ever worked at a food bank and you've handed out that last box and there's, you know, 5 cars left, if you're like me, you're wondering like, oh my gosh, where can I get food for these people? Because they just happen to be the last 5 cars. So I think it's a balancing act would be the short answer.
Tom, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We heard on the Ideas Network Facebook page from Brandy, who says, my main client is a homeless shelter in Milwaukee. I do get paid, but I also do pro bono work. I put so much energy in because I believe in their mission and that they're actually helping. And that's a thought, people donating their talent, if they have unique skills that, you know, they might be how they make a living, donating those to organizations in need, Lisa.
Absolutely. You know, that if you're a lawyer, an attorney, if you're a graphic artist, if you're an accountant, you know, those are skills that might be needed at a nonprofit organization that you could go in. If you're an architect and they're wanting to build a new building, you could donate your services and they're valued. You know, nonprofits have gotten very astute and we actually track and value hours of volunteers, and they're valued differently. I served on the board of a legal aid clinic in Chicago, and we valued the time and the donated time of lawyers different than, you know, someone like me who comes in and answers the phone or does intake of clients that needed the services, the legal aid services. So usually when you're working for a nonprofit, you also volunteer some time and you get your friends and family involved too. So that's a great thing that Brandy's doing.
We are talking about giving in this holiday season and beyond. Lisa Dietlin is with us, expert on giving and philanthropy. Still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your questions, maybe your own experiences. We heard from CK, who wants to encourage people to support their local health departments, especially for those with disabilities and people with eye injuries, because they're often underhelped, under-supported. I'll throw in a thank you to the people who volunteered to read for Bard. My dad has come to depend on it with some vision changes for audiobooks. Lisa, what do you think of that as a way, as a place to look for an opportunity to volunteer?
I think it's great. You know, there's so many ways. And if you have access to the internet, simply doing a Google search or contacting your local community foundation. If you don't have the internet, making a phone call, you know, checking in with your city hall or your county officials. They know where the need is in your community. And there's a lot of things that we learned during the COVID pandemic, which, you know, as we know, is still going on. But we got smarter about how we can volunteer and how we can engage people. It's not always that you have to leave your home and go to a facility. There are things that people can do to help nonprofit organizations from their home.
Lisa, people might wonder if they're looking to give money now, specifically, how can I make sure that I'm giving to a legitimate organization that's doing the good work that I assume they're doing when I send them my money?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I always cringe because I say if people would only use their force for good, because you can get tripped up and end up accidentally donating to a fraudulent website that looks like the real website. So first of all, I never respond to anything that comes into my inbox. And I know a lot of development officers are probably cringing in nonprofits like, oh my gosh. What I do is if it interests me, I search that on the internet to find the website and make sure it's real. I might place a call. I might send an email. I might start small with a donation. Those are all safeguard measures. And they're actually best practices of those individuals that at the top of the show, Rob, that you talked about, that give large gifts. Sometimes they'll just give a $50 gift to see if it's processed and if they get a thank you note and if it really went to where it was supposed to be. And I think we all have to take a page out of the Mackenzie Scott book. You know, Mackenzie Scott is making transformational gifts all over the country with no strings attached. And I think there has to be some faith that nonprofits know where the resources, the leadership knows where the resources should go. That said, we do have to have checks and balances. So if you're serving on a board of directors or if you're working on a staff of a nonprofit, make sure those checks and balances are there, because I truly believe that when nonprofits get tripped up because of embezzlement or bad behavior, it's because something's happening in an individual staff member's life that hasn't been addressed, that they're not sharing, and this is the only way they think they can fix it. So I think we have to have some trust and move away from the I need to control the gift where it goes, and hopefully trust that those nonprofits in our community are doing good.
And one place where you differ from some of those, you know, advisors we can look up online, you think it's okay if there are decent salaries for workers at nonprofit. You don't view that necessarily as a bad sign.
Absolutely. You know what? I'm going to talk to Joe Biden at the White House. And, you know, I've got a posse going and say, you know, there needs to be a living wage for nonprofit workers. You know, it's we are not volunteers. The nonprofit sector, Rob, you've heard me say this, is the third largest employment sector in this country after retail and manufacturing. More people work in this field than work in the automotive industry, oil and gas, or electronics. Yet until very recently, nobody grew up and said, hey, mom and dad, I want to work in the nonprofit, the charitable sector. And they need to be paid a living wage. You shouldn't be paying them a wage that forces them to go down the street to be in the food bank line, the soup kitchen line, because you're not paying them a sustainable wage. And we as community have to understand that separating out salaries from program and thinking we're being astute donors is not. I mean, could you live? I had this one friend and she would say to me, well, Lisa, I don't give to a charity that spends more than 3% on overhead. And I said, well, then you're a fool. And she looked at me and said, could you and your husband live on 3% of your salary, on 3% of your income that's coming in? She goes, no. I said, then how are you expecting a nonprofit to do that? And I can tell you they're burying it. They're burying it under education. They're burying it under marketing. Let's trust the nonprofit. Let's pay people a living wage. Or a recent term that I learned, Rob, is a family sustaining wage. Let's pay people a wage that they can do good. At that legal aid clinic I worked at, we would pay, and now this is about 15 years ago, entry level attorneys that were doing family housing, criminal law, family law, we would pay them under $40,000 a year. They wanted to work in the public sector, but guess what? 6-12 months later, their law school bills came due and they left us. And I remember we said, we need to pay them. We can't pay them what the law firms are paying them, but we can do better than under $40,000 a year.
Lisa, thanks again for joining us today.
Oh, always happy to talk about one of my favorite subjects. And no matter what you do, whether it be with your time, with your blood, your sweat, or your dollars, just know you're making a difference. And even a smile or a kind word can change somebody's life.
That's Lisa Dietlin with the Institute of Transformational Philanthropy talking about giving back during the holiday season and beyond. Coming up, a biography of a key player in American diplomacy before Pearl Harbor. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, sports gambling is rising in more states. That means a greater risk for problem gambling and addiction. We'll learn more about the warning signs and how to help someone you might be concerned about. Now we look back at what led up to the surprise attack on Pearl Harbor 81 years ago today. Here's President Franklin D. Roosevelt speaking to Congress in the aftermath of the attack.
Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy. The United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan. The United States was at peace with that nation, and at the solicitation of Japan, was still in conversation with its government and its emperor, looking toward the maintenance of peace in the Pacific.
We're going to dig into that conversation and that diplomatic history today and learn about a figure at the center of the story, the U.S. ambassador in Tokyo at the time of the attack. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about what led up to the Pearl Harbor attack? What do you remember hearing about it at the time, if you were around with us then, or from your parents or your grandparents? What questions do you have on this anniversary? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Steve Kemper is a journalist and author of several books. His latest is called Our Man in Tokyo, An American Ambassador and the Countdown to Pearl Harbor. Steve, welcome to Central Time. Do we have you there? There we do. Steve, let's start with the ambassador at the center of your story before he gets to this very difficult situation in Japan. Can you tell us a little bit about the career of Joseph Clark Grew?
Sure. He was born to Boston Brahmins, grew up on Beacon Hill, went to prep school at Groton, and then followed his father and brothers to Harvard. That was where the Grews went. And when he got out of Harvard, he was expected to go into Boston business or banking. He had no interest in those things at all. So eventually he ended up going into the State Department instead of going onto State Street. He served in 14 posts during his career. He was more or less a legend in the State Department because of his accomplishments and his post and what he had done. And that's why in 1932, when the Japanese invaded Manchuria, President Herbert Hoover decided to send our best man to the most difficult mission in the world at the time, Japan.
And let's talk about what he's walking into in Japan. And this is amazing. He gets word. He's going to be the ambassador to Japan. He's on his way, you know, I think taking the train across the country to take a ship over to Japan. When news breaks, the Japanese prime minister assassinated by radical far-right members of the Japanese military. What was he in for with this appointment?
A roller coaster ride. He called it actually like he was living on a volcano. Japan was a mess. Before I started researching this book, I didn't have much idea about it. And we all know about the 30s in Europe, Germany and Italy and so on. But this was a mystery to me, and it was fascinating. It was complete chaos over there. This wasn't the first assassination, or would it be the last? It was the second prime minister assassinated within 18 months. There were plots, conspiracies. There were internecine wars within the right wing. Some people were not right wing enough for other right wingers. There were patriotic societies that they called themselves patriotic societies that were essentially right wing groups that were intent upon overthrowing any cabinet that wanted to have closer relations with the Western nations. So Grew had a handful.
Oh, the amazing thing is reading your book, and I didn't really realize this so much. The first question is, who am I the ambassador to? Because you had the emperor, right, who is the ultimate, acknowledged leader, almost a cult-like devotion to the emperor of Japan, and actually has no practical power to do anything. There's what looks like a civilian government with a prime minister and a cabinet and a parliament sort of thing, except they don't control the army and navy, which are sort of under the emperor. And they sort of appoint their own leaders without any input from the prime minister. There's a question as to who actually has the power to make any significant decision.
You've got that exactly right. That was Grew's dilemma. An ambassador has to figure out where are the levers of power and influence. And in most countries, it's pretty easy. It's the despot, or it's the political leaders, or it's clear. In Japan, there were all these little centers of power. And they were all competing, the palace advisors, the emperor, the military, and the branches of the military were competing with each other. Then you had the, as you said, the cabinet, and then you had the parliament, or diet, as it was called there. So, and then all these right-wing patriotic societies also had quite a say in how people were feeling about things. So Grew did his best, but it was a maze. It was kind of chaotic.
We're talking to Steve Kemper about his new book, Our Man in Tokyo, an American ambassador and the countdown to Pearl Harbor, focused on the ambassador Joseph Clark Grew in the run-up to war between Japan and the United States. If you have questions about that era, the lead-up to that war and to Pearl Harbor, which we commemorate today, you can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. A big question here is, of course, I think, was war with Japan, or from Japan's perspective, was war with the United States inevitable? How did Joseph Clark Grew try to figure out as he navigated this complex situation?
Well, an ambassador's primary task is to maintain peace between his country and the host country. And that's what Grew put all of his energies into right up to the very end. And I mean the very end, the night before Pearl Harbor happened. He was still working for peace. So he spent 10 years trying to do it. Whether the question you asked at the beginning, was war inevitable, mm-hmm. That's the $100,000 question, of course. Grew, he believed up to the end that it was not inevitable. But looking back on it now, it appears that there was nothing he could do to stop this wave of fanaticism. This group of right wingers was determined to expand the imperial empire. Their egomania and their quest for power was immense, and Gru did everything he could to stop it. And it looked like a few times there might have been a chance to avert it or to postpone it, but they were always overwhelmed in the end by the right wing passion for expansion.
Now, of course, Gru, as ambassador, is navigating this tough situation in Japan. He's also looking over his shoulder at the State Department and the president and Washington, and sometimes frustrated by the messages he was getting from back home and that the Japanese public and leadership was getting from the United States. What kind of things did he see as making his job more difficult?
Well, if you want to talk about the State Department, he was a good soldier in his own self-description. So, and his job as an ambassador is to convey the policies of his country to the host government. He always did that. Behind the scenes, however, in his letters, in his diary, he was sometimes frustrated, as you said, because the U.S., in particular, Secretary of State Cordell Hull, could be intransigent. He could, his standards were so high, his ideals were so high that they made him inflexible sometimes. Whereas Gru, as a diplomat, is working on the art of compromise. And that means being flexible. So sometimes Gru's classical opinion.
Now, from time to time, Gru is warning, hey, war is definitely a possibility with Japan. But he's also encouraging, I think, if I'm reading you right, the American government not to do too much saber rattling and to be willing to negotiate and compromise. Can you talk about how he tried to thread that needle?
Oh, boy. That's a really good question. He tried to thread it by knowing what the pressure points were on both sides. An ambassador sort of in the middle. He's working in two directions, towards his government, towards the host government. So he's trying to gather information from both sides and then use that to figure out where is my path. And he tried to do that with the Japanese in several ways. He kept things behind the scenes. That's sort of the definition of diplomacy, at least from Gru, by telling them, you need to stop doing some of the things you're doing, such as bombing American properties in Japan, taking over property. You need to stop doing that. You keep promising you will, and you don't. And if you don't stop, the American public is going to get angry. You think that they're a bunch of isolationists and pacifists who won't go to war, but I'm telling you, the sheepskin will come off and the lion will come roaring out, and you'll be sorry. On the Japan side, on the American side, he was telling Hull, these people are fanatical and they are capable of sudden dramatic actions, and we need to try to figure out a way for them to save face, to be able to back off of some of the things they're doing so that we can find a path towards peace.
We're talking to author Steve Kemper about his new book, Our Man in Tokyo, An American Ambassador and the Countdown to Pearl Harbor. Today is Pearl Harbor Day, commemorating the 1941 attack on Pearl Harbor. This ambassador in Tokyo at the center of the story. You can join in with your questions for our guest about his research, his work on the run-up to World War II, U.S. involvement in World War II. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with journalist and author Steve Kemper on the anniversary of the attack on Pearl Harbor. We're talking about his new book. It's called Our Man in Tokyo, An American Ambassador and the Countdown to Pearl Harbor, centering around that ambassador, Joseph Clark Gru, his efforts to prevent World War II, or at least American involvement in it, a war with Japan in the Pacific. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring in a caller. Michael is with us in Mequon. Michael, hi.
Hi, thanks for the call. Very interesting topic. My understanding is that there was a document called the Tanaka Memorial that may have been published around 1928 that outlined the idea that Japan was destined to be the superior power in the Pacific, and that the U.S. was the primary blockage to attaining that goal. I've read that some historians have thought that that was a fictitious document, that it was written by perhaps British intelligence to help drive the U.S. In a direction against Japan. Do you have any insights into whether the Tanaka Memorial was real and did it have a significant effect on Japanese strategy?
Interesting question, Michael. Steve, there is a lot of historical controversy about this thing.
Well, I don't know much about that particular document, but I can tell you that the contents, as you describe them, were not made up by British intelligence. Those were just the facts as the Japanese believed them. They did think that they were destined for imperial glory in the Far East. They thought that they were destined to rule the Far East. They were the superior race in Asia, as Germany felt they were the superior race in Europe. They felt that the United States was the principal obstacle to that goal because Britain was on one knee in the war. France had been defeated. The Netherlands had been defeated. The only thing standing between them and taking over was, what is the United States going to do? And so that document is, maybe it's part of some conspiracy by some people, but I know for a fact that that's what was believed by most of the people in Japan.
Michael, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Your book covers really a 10-year period when Drew becomes the ambassador to Japan up through Pearl Harbor. Let's move in a little closer. Now, November 3rd, 1941, about a month before the Pearl Harbor attack, Drew in a dispatch includes the line, "Armed conflict with the United States might come with dangerous and dramatic suddenness." Can you talk about that last month of scramble to prevent that armed conflict?
Well, this is interesting because there's sort of two streams going into it. There's what Grew sensed and knew from being in Japan, and his information, his informants, many of them had dried up because it had become very dangerous to come to the embassy. It had become very dangerous even to speak English on the streets or anywhere else. But he sensed what was happening because of the contacts that he had, which were still strong, to the cabinet and the palace. On the other side, you had this program called MAGIC. We had decrypted the diplomatic traffic, Japan's diplomatic code, so that FDR and Hull knew exactly what was going back and forth between Tokyo and Washington, Tokyo and Berlin. They knew what the Japanese were planning, and that was also two-pronged. On the one hand, they were continuing to negotiate, and on the other side, they made clear they were planning for war, and both those things were in the diplomatic cables that Hull and FDR were reading. So as we got about the early November, the date had been set, and there wasn't much that anybody could do. The military had agreed that if by some miracle the United States will give us everything that we want, then we're not going to attack. But meanwhile, you diplomats keep talking. And they started to move troops, and we were aware of that troop movement, but of course it's not like today. We just had sporadic reports about it. We didn't have any good, hard information about it. So that on the night before Pearl Harbor, for instance, FDR sent a cable directly to Hirohito through Grew. He was instructed Grew to deliver it, saying, "We are the leaders of our nations. It looks like your nation is heading towards a plan for war. I hope that we as the leaders can stop this, because it would be terrible for both of our countries." And Grew delivered that at midnight to the foreign minister the night before Pearl Harbor. The foreign minister knew it was too late. He knew that you know, this was a dead letter, essentially. He took that cable. He said he would deliver it. The next morning, Grew got up, and he had a message to come see the foreign minister right away. So he dressed, went over there. The foreign minister handed him some papers saying we're breaking off negotiations. That's all he said. And Gru thought, being the optimist that he was, well, I'll work on this in a few days. He went home, put on his golfing togs to go play golf. And then you heard the newsboys in the street crying, war is declared. Japan has bombed Pearl Harbor. So that's how Gru found out about it. It was a very intense few weeks beforehand. And I'm leaving a lot out, of course, condensing a lot here.
Sure. We are talking about the career of American Ambassador Joseph Clark Gru. Our guest is Steve Kemper, author of the book Our Man in Tokyo, An American Ambassador and the Countdown to Pearl Harbor. On this, the anniversary of the Pearl Harbor attack. Let's bring on another caller now. Brad is with us in McHenry, Illinois. Brad, hi.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. What do you want to bring up?
Well, I was curious. He brought up the primary duty of any ambassador is to keep peace with the nation that they're assigned to as ambassador. So if he had been successful in his duties and Japan had never attacked Pearl Harbor, what may have brought the United States into war with Japan, aside from that, and where would we be today? Where would China be who, you know, Japan had invaded and was, to my knowledge, faring fairly poorly against them, you know, before the United States got involved and took a lot of Japan's war resources.
Brad, I gotcha. Thanks for the question. Steve, I don't know if we can get up to the present day, but absent that attack, I mean, a lot of people viewed on both sides the situation in the Pacific and the, you know, Japanese occupation of much of China and elsewhere as an unacceptable state of affairs. Putting off the Pearl Harbor attack, would it have really guaranteed peace for that much longer?
I doubt it. It's one of those hypotheticals that you never know. Mm-hmm. As I mentioned before, Japan seemed determined to expand. The United States was determined that that would not happen, at least not without limits. The United States had been very patient and had tried many, many different avenues to shore up or maintain or, you know, challenge Japan to stop in order before things got out of hand. Nothing worked. Nothing. Nothing from Washington. Nothing from Gru. So I don't know. I'm afraid it seems kind of inevitable.
Thanks for that question. I want to talk a little bit about the aftermath for Ambassador Gru and his staff. Japan bombs Pearl Harbor. In effect, Gru and the American embassy are almost prisoners as much as they are diplomats at that point. Can you talk about the journey from the Pearl Harbor attack to them returning to New York?
Sure. Of course, after Japan bombed Pearl Harbor, Gru and his staff were actually no longer diplomats. They had no contact with the Japanese government. They were just interned. They were prisoners of war inside the embassy. That lasted for 6 months as both sides negotiated the release of their respective diplomatic corps. In that 6 months, Gru wrote what he called his final report from Japan, which was his analysis of what had happened and why. It was 277 pages long or something like that. When he got back to the U.S., he gave it to Secretary of Hull straight away. And with the gist of it, Hull looked through it and threw it back across the desk at Gru and told him to destroy every copy he had of it. So Gru did put it in his papers at Harvard, but he noted that 133 pages had been eliminated. And he also left in, though, a cover letter that he had written while he was on the ship coming back, a cover letter to FDR, 13 pages. And that's still in the archive. And when he refers in that letter to his final report, there's a Gru's little handwritten note saying, destroyed at Mr. Hull's request, which when you're a researcher, that's an exquisite little find, because it's Gru saying there was a crime committed here and I'm not going to cover it up.
And it's got to be tantalizing and frustrating for you as a researcher, knowing that it existed at one point and probably doesn't.
Well, that's sort of the takeoff point of my book, because the issue is Gru wanted to know, could we have done anything different? That was Gru's pressing question for himself and for his government. And so it became mine for my book. And you can find Gru's answer to it in all of his letters. He wrote so many letters, 6,000 pages of his diary just in Tokyo. and all of his dispatches back and forth. So if you dig through everything, you begin to get a sense like something arising out of the stone. There is an image that comes to the surface.
Steve, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. I enjoyed it.
That's Steve Kemper. We talked to him about his new book, Our Man in Tokyo, An American Ambassador and the Countdown to Pearl Harbor, on this, the anniversary of the Pearl Harbor attacks. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, if I get a firsthand perspective on toy stores in the Christmas season, that's tomorrow on the Ideas Network. Yesterday on the show, we talked about children's games, songs, and customs that make up what's called child lore, things that kids learn from other kids and pass them on. A lot of you shared your memories on the air and on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Here's one more on Facebook. Danny tells us, we played a game when I was a kid called Ghost in the Graveyard. It was a combination of tag and hide and seek. One person played the ghost, counted to 10. The others had to hide. Once the person was seeking the people who hid, found one, that person would shout out, Ghost in the Graveyard, and everyone had to run to a safe place. Now the person who was the ghost is supposed to tag one of those people before they make it to the safe place. They become the ghost, and it starts all over again. Danny says, my daughter taught this to my grandson. My grandson took it to Cub Scout camp, taught all of his friends at Cub Scouts, and they were playing it all night long into the evening. Thanks, Danny. I played that game. We didn't call it Ghost in the Graveyard, just like a version of tag, I guess. You can keep sharing your memories on the Ideas Network Facebook page.